Today in Studio 360, is there any actual pop star more singular, more distinctive, more downright peculiar than Björk? Or, as you might call her, Bjork? Björk's music and fashions and videos are currently the big deal show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Her music, of course, sounds like nobody else's, and that means she's had to invent some of the instruments to play it with.
I have an instrument that has the silvery metallic notes that sound celestial. It's called Celesta, but it reads MIDI, so you can just plug it with your iPad.
And from Icelandic art rock to the songs that rule the American pop charts, we'll learn the secret ingredient in the most infectious songs of the last 50 years. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360. But to start the show, last weekend, a young composer was scheduled to make his Carnegie Hall debut. Jonas Tarm is just 21, a star student at the New England Conservatory of Music. His 9-minute piece was a commission that he got after winning a big competition last year. A composer's dream come true. But no. The New York Youth Symphony canceled the piece just days before the concert after it got an angry letter from somebody who had heard an earlier performance. Tarm grew up in Chicago, but he's from Eastern Europe. He was born in Estonia, and he calls his piece Marsh une butia, which means March to Oblivion in Ukrainian. And the issue is a 45-second quotation in the piece from the Nazi anthem called the Horst Wessel Song. To figure out what's going on here, I decided I had to talk to Alex Ross, who is the music critic for The New Yorker and the author of The Rest Is Noise. Alex, welcome back to Studio 360.
Thanks, Kurt. Great to be back.
So this is not the very first time some classical composer has quoted Horst Wessel, right?
Oh, no. There's been a string of pieces going back actually to an unfinished symphony by the composer Pavel Haas, who died in Auschwitz. And there have been a number of other composers who've quoted it in pieces, usually in the same sense of surrounding it with an orchestral background that obviously casts doubt on the melody that undercuts it and distorts it.
And you have read the score. You're expert enough to know what it sounds like and how it was used. And talk about that. How did you read the quotation of this Nazi song?
How a composer presents a melody like this can really change the meaning of it quite drastically. You hear the melody for a few bars in the bassoons, which, you know, stereotypically in the orchestra, one of the roles they play is sort of communicating an idea of some pompous figure or a comical figure. And then in the fourth bar, there's immediately this series of noises from the rest of the orchestra. And so, you know, the orchestra is commenting on the melody, undercutting it, distorting it, making it grotesque. And this continues on as the tune plays more and more frenzied activity in the orchestra surrounding the melody, and eventually by the end drowning out completely in the sort of, you know, full eruption of the orchestra. So, you know, we get the idea. You know, I mean, yeah. I haven't heard the piece, but this melody is being equated with something dark and monstrous and grotesque.
Right. We tried to get the New York Youth Symphony to talk to us, and they declined to comment. On their website, that they suggest that because this some explicit teaching moment explanation of exactly why was this song quoted here wasn't included in his program note, they couldn't perform it. And they said, without this information, quote, and given the lack of transparency and the lack of parental consent to engage with this music, we could not continue to feature his work in the program. I don't know. I mean, yes, some of these kids in the orchestra are in their teens, 13, 14, as well, up to 22. But parental consent, I don't know. I'm not buying that. How about you?
Yeah, well, it raises some difficult issues. I mean, so now is every composer being commissioned by the orchestra going to have to look over his or her shoulder and think about, oh, if I make a reference to some known melody, you know, how is it going to be received? If you put on The Sound of Music at a high school, you know, are people going to be pulled in the wrong direction by, you know, sort of references to Nazis in that musical. I mean, I would love to know more about, certainly about what this composer was up to. You know, he's Estonian. There's this very deep fear and trepidation in Estonia now about what Putin is up to.
Right.
They see themselves as next in line after Ukraine. And so I'm guessing, just off the top of my head, that this piece has something to do with contemporary Russia and Ukraine, as well as the history under the Soviets and the Nazis. But he didn't say
right.
it. But I think, you know, if the composer won't provide the teaching moment, why not just do it yourself? You know, talk about the Horst Wessel Lied. Talk about other pieces that have quoted this. Again, it seems obvious to me what he's up to
yeah.
in quoting. I do think it explains itself. And just go from there. But to remove the piece altogether and have this, you know, big announcement that appears in the New York Times seems a rather drastic move to me.
Yes, even if most of the commentary and criticism is on your side, you don't want to be that
no.
guy at 21. Probably.
Absolutely not. But it is, you know, it's a fascinating subject. Irony in music, it's tricky. People argue on and on about Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, a piece which the New York Youth Symphony has performed. First, it was seen as an endorsement of Stalin's Soviet Union, almost as a propaganda work later.
And basically written under duress, you know, under threat of trial or death by Stalin.
Yeah. Later, this theory emerged that there's an ironic dimension to it, that this triumphal conclusion is not supposed to be a true triumph, but it's a fake one, a propaganda, hollow, pompous triumph. And people go back and forth and back and forth on that, you know, and there are many other pieces in the repertory, pieces that quote melodies associated with the Civil War South and Dixie and Stephen Foster melodies and on and on. You know, there's a lot of charged, difficult material in the classical repertory, and we just can't, you know, grind to a halt and discuss it and try to pin down exactly what it means, you know, every time these pieces are played.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt.
Alex Ross is a music critic for The New Yorker and the author of The Rest is Noise. So, what do you think? Alex and I were arguing that an artist ought to be able to incorporate challenging references in his work without footnotes, necessarily. Do you agree? Or do you think that maybe in this case, the composer did need to explain his intentions publicly? Leave us a comment at studio360.org.
Welcome to biophilia, the love for nature in all her manifestations.
Hold on. We're not about to look at waterfalls and watch lions attacking wildebeests.
Much of nature is hidden from us, that we can neither see nor touch, like the one phenomenon that can be said to move us more than any other in our daily lives. Sound.
That is David Attenborough, king of the nature documentary, narrating Biophilia, the project from Björk that expanded the boundaries of what a pop album could be into film, art, and interactive technology. It's a one-of-a-kind thing, which is to say, a very Björk thing. She's now got a major retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art in New York, surveying her remarkably multifaceted career. I spoke with Björk back when Biophilia came out and asked how it came to be.
I started off with this project thinking that it would be like the frustrated music teacher in me getting out and making some educational apps for children.
Right.
But I ended up actually learning tons myself, so...
About science, about music, about both?
Like the whole thing. So I it was sort of like I went to school as well, you know, last 3 years.
What did you learn? Most amazingly,
I would say. I watched a lot of DVDs and read books, and I guess I've sort of updated my look on things. I think this whole project was kind of based a little bit around the touchscreen, which we had in electronic music for a while. So... when I was touring the Volta Tour from 2006 to 2008, we were performing with touchscreens, and that sort of became the beginning point, the entry point for this project for me.
As you became comfortable with that tool?
Yeah, that I wanted not just to perform with it, but write with it. I see who you are. And that sort of tapped into that I wanted to re-look again at how I saw musicology.
Uh-huh.
And I felt this was sort of a tool that I could do that, not only with music writing, but also with teaching.
This is about the most ambitious project I've ever heard of in my life. It's amazing. Let's take a look, just to give a sense of the ambition, which people at home can also do, at this iPad that's sitting here. There you are. There's Biophilia. Now, what comes up initially is a very lovely black and white view of space with some constellations. Even though, of course, constellations aren't really scientific. So should we look at Crystalline, which is the one that I touch it?
Directly on the star.
Okay. And it explodes. So there's lots of things you can do here. There's play, animation, lyrics, credits, score. Let's do score. I touch score.
Yeah, score is basically more traditional music score.
Yeah, I see a kind of beautiful yellow, red, white, green sheet music basically scrolling across the screen here.
Yeah, it's scrolling in the right speed of the song, and you can either do the karaoke and sing along.
Because the lyrics are there.
Yeah, or you could turn the sound off.
Right, which you do here.
And then you could put it just on your piano or whatever and play along.
And you have the little metronomic sound here.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I like the music better, unless you're going to sing.
Maybe not right now.
Okay.
And then we have another score. It says animation,
right.
And that's more like a visualization of the song.
We see visuals here of a beautiful green and blue and yellow dots of various shades sort of responding to the music. And again, scrolling in this progressive way that is more an abstraction of the music.
Yeah, I mean, it's more just like blobs. It's based on the notation of the song, but it's kind of more for people who don't know anything about notation. So, I mean, I wanted to blur these lines between, like, classical music notation and MIDI information, which is basically the same thing.
MIDI information being all the ways that music is put into digital form.
Exactly. And I mean, it's just the same thing. So it's basically an attempt to sort of do the Kofi Annan and build bridges between those two little worlds that actually are the same.
You are a big line blurrer in many ways. you like blurring the lines, yeah?
I think out of all projects I've done, it's been sort of more about building bridges. I don't think it's so much inventing new things. It's more about building bridges.
Uh-huh.
Heaven, heaven's bodies whirl around me, make me one. Universe was an empty sea until a silver fox entered cunning mate.
That is Cosmology from Björk's album Biophilia. So what musical ideas or lessons did you intend to introduce to your audience with this project?
It looked at sort of 101 introduction to people who haven't learned about musicology.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, a little bit about the rhythm, a little bit about time signatures, a little bit about scales, a little bit about arpeggios. And then if people then want to go and learn the violin for 30 years, they
right.
can, you know.
Right. It's also a cool record. Let's listen to one of the tracks, which is called Thunderbolt.
Thank you. Universal intimacy. Miracles, may I, can I?
That's Thunderbolt from Björk's album Biophilia. So how else is the music on this album connected with the natural world and physics and biology and all the rest of science?
I try to approach it from as different angles as possible, obviously with the subject matter of being where music and nature meet. You could go have 5 billions of subject matters. But I wanted to do the sort of most obvious ones, sort of like if I'm introducing music to a child. Another song is basically a virus that takes over your song, and it's sort of like a tongue-in-cheek pun on generative music. Yeah, basically you have a cute pop song singing about viruses, but then the virus actually takes over the song and wins in the end.
And it's called Virus, that song.
Yeah.
Like a virus needs a body. Soft tissue feeds on blood. Someday I'll find you. The urge is here. Ooh.
And then there is, let me think, crystalline, which that's more about structure and how you experience spatially.
Uh-huh.
For example, the verses are quite claustrophobic tunnels, but the choruses are wide open nebulae.
Crystalline, internal nebulae. Crystalline, rocks growing slow-mer. Crystalline, I compare claustrophobia.
Created some original instruments or commissioned them to be made. Talk about some of those.
I did try to work out a gamelan orchestra. I mean, I think 1 year through this project, we just totally ran out of budget. So the last 2 years, we've been making these DIY punk decisions. It's actually been quite liberating.
And you combined a gamelan and this thing called the Celeste, which is a kind of a piano.
Yeah, so basically I have an instrument quite old, which is, yeah, looks like a small stand-up piano.
Uh-huh.
And that has these silvery kind of notes, metallic notes, that sound quite celestial. That's why it's called Celesta. And then we gutted that and got this bronze note made instead and replaced them. And bronze is the same material as a gamelan is.
Uh-huh.
So it sounds like some sort of like a hybrid between the two. But and then it's just plugged in. It reads MIDI, so basically you can just plug it with your iPad.
And people should go look at pictures of these online at our website, because they're beautiful things. They're these kind of wonderful steampunk contraptions that are absolutely gorgeous. They look like theatrical props, but as you say, they're the real deal, right? They really play.
Yeah, it's been real fun.
Part of your intention is to make music and music education more accessible to children. Your second child is young, right? Was having this little kid around helpful in that procedure?
Yeah, totally. I mean, she's really musical. And I guess me kind of trying to decide which direction to go to, you know, and just seeing her, like, sit down and play with some of the apps and stuff.
So you had a little focus group to experiment on.
My own personal guinea pig. Yeah, I guess I was thinking if you have a kid that has a touchscreen in its lap, then technology is doing what it's best at. It's taking complicated algorithms, and then you can control it with one finger. But then I liked it to be connected with acoustic sounds, because I feel sometimes with children, when they're too much doing computer games, that they get stuck in this kind of virtual world.
Right.
So I wanted somehow to have this exit point somehow.
Björk, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
A retrospective of the musician and artist Björk is now on view at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. And you can see a video of one of the tracks from Biophilia at studio360.org.
Björk has made her musical career out of never playing it safe. But if you're trying for maximum commercial success, there's one thing you'll definitely want to include. We'll let you in on the secret formula. That's coming up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. If you listen to the giant pop music hits, they tend to have something in common. Because you know I'm all about that bass, no trouble. Why you gotta be so rude? Don't say I didn't, warn ya. Give up what that secret is? Steven Jackson has our answer.
If we're going to talk about American pop music, there's only one place to start.
The Billboard Hot 100 is the most authoritative pop singles chart in the United States.
Keith Caulfield is an associate director at Billboard. They produce a lot of music charts, and the Hot 100 is the big one.
We have a very fancy formula, very scientific mathematical formula.
Where they plug in music purchases, airplay, and online streaming.
And out comes a bunch of points, and then we rank them.
They've been at it since 1958. But if you ask Keith what makes a song climb to number one, he'll tell you what you already know. It takes a solid beat, a catchy hook, being Taylor Swift, and still.
You can check off all of those checkboxes, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that song is going to become a hit. Because otherwise, everyone would have a hit single, and we'd all be incredibly wealthy. And it doesn't work that way.
There's no formula for the perfect hit. But if you're of a statistical cast of mind, like Professor Joe Nunez, you're still gotta wonder.
What are the really big hits, those number one songs, and what distinguishes them from songs that sort of made it to a broad audience but didn't quite get that power of number one?
Joe is a marketing professor at the University of Southern California. He's also a musician.
I play guitar and do so pretty poorly.
A few years ago, Joe started studying pop. Actually, he hired a team of grad students. They listened to all the number one hits on the Hot 100 and to the bottom dwellers, tracks that never made it above number 90 on the chart. Joe and his team coded every song by its unique combination of sounds. It's pop recipe.
The sound of a guitar, the sound of drums, the sound of a bass.
And the factor that separates number ones from the pack, more than anything else?
Background vocals.
Good 60% of all the Billboard number one hits had backup singers. Now, 60% doesn't sound huge, but bear with me on the numbers. Drums show up in 95% of top songs. No surprise there, but they were just as likely to be in the bottom-ranked songs, so they're not relevant. One sound that was more likely to reach number one was the synthesizer, but that popularity mostly came in a surge during the 70s and 80s when synth pop dominated the charts. So, across the whole data set, over half a century of pop, the best predictor of a number one hit is backup singers.
Is this ranked in any particular order?
But this I is brought this Keith Caulfield at Billboard a copy of Joe Nunez's research article because Keith doesn't subscribe to the Journal of the European Society for the Cognitive Sciences of Music. And Keith was skeptical at first.
Oh, this is background vocals with a clean guitar and a synthesizer. Man, they're very specific, aren't they?
But it's hard to argue with the data.
Britney Spears' Baby One More Time. You hear like three or four people singing Baby One More Time behind her. So that makes sense.
By the end of our meeting, Keith came around.
People appreciate the idea of background vocals. They like harmonies. They like groups of voices that sound good together. It makes them feel good, and there's something that goes off in their brain that says, I like this song. You know, you probably feel more comfortable with a group of vocalists, and you sound better in the car when you sing along with them.
Dr. Elizabeth Margulis calls this imaginative participation. Margulis directs the Music Cognition Lab at the University of Arkansas, and she says you can see this imaginative participation in the brain.
When you're lying there in an fMRI scanner listening, you see all this activity in motor planning regions. So there's this very kind of literal sense in which some kind of participatory mechanisms are at play.
After all, passively listening to music is a relatively recent thing.
You know, if you look at the way music's used historically and across cultures, you'll find its use in ritual and everybody's joining in and playing and dancing and hanging out together.
And while lead vocalists can be hard to imitate, backup singers give you a way in.
People talk about a sense of merging with the music, a sense that the boundaries between themselves and the sound have dissolved and that they've become one with it in some way.
The desire to sing along is like an instinct. Everybody does it, except Keith Caulfield. His career in pop has ruined him. He knows too much.
I'd like to think that I could carry a tune, but no. I mean, I could probably play a mean cowbell. Like, I'm really probably great on tambourine. I could probably play a bongo drum.
For Studio 360, I'm Stephen Jackson.
There is another fascinating and totally different way to look at the Billboard charts and their DNA, their essence. R. Luc Dubois is an artist and computer programmer who is all about presenting big data in a beautiful way. Dubois developed a technique he calls time-lapse phonography. He used it to distill four decades of Billboard's pop music charts into a single piece of music. That's hundreds of tunes sampled and compressed into 37 minutes. He calls the piece Billboard.
So if we take a song like from 1966, if we take Diana Ross and the Supremes, Keep Me Hanging On. Set me free, why don't you pay? I play it through a computer program I've written. It just looks at the spectrum, it looks at the frequencies and the components and the sound, and just averages it over time, much as you would average the stock market or any other thing. And then eventually you just end up with this long sustained chord. For every week a song is at number one, you get 1 second of sound. So if you spend 10 weeks at the top of the charts, your song lasts 10 seconds. And I string them all together, just chronologically. You know, I didn't write this music, and I didn't curate this music. It was curated by, you know, young Americans of the last 50 years who bought records and called into the radio. This was curated by other people, millions of other people. I'm just figuring out an algorithm, a way to sort of present it for people to listen to. But the piece lasts about 37 minutes, through which you hear from 1958 to 2000. What you do is you get kind of a snapshot of the piece, and you can sing the song over it and tell that it's in the right key. You just keep me hanging on. You don't really need me anymore. And you can tell things about how the record was produced. Over time, these averages get noisier and noisier because drums, which are basically noise, get louder and louder in record mixing. Since the 50s. The key areas change over time. So in the 50s and 60s, you get a lot of songs still that are in brass keys. They're in keys like B flat and E flat. And by the time you get into the 80s and 90s, almost everything's in the key of C and G and D and A, sort of common guitar keys. And some really interesting things happen, like in the sort of high disco period, everything stabilizes to the key of D for some reason, all those BG songs. There were a few moments like that where it sort of would level out and something about the sound would really change. Hip-hop tunes becoming number ones. The only real pitched tone becomes things like the bass line. And the rest of it is just this kind of veneer of noise from the rapping and the drums. If you ask someone who was sort of alive and listening to the radio at the time what would be their most important song, maybe from any given year, what they say and what the chart says probably aren't the same thing. So a good one is 1967, right? The Beatles song, All You Need Is Love, only spent 1 week at number one. The big hit that year was probably To Sir With Love by Lulu, I would bet. 5 weeks at number one. Are we going to get to the point in our culture where people have a hard time listening to a 2.5 minute pop song without channel surfing? I see people do this on their iPods all the time. They'll listen to songs only through the first chorus and then they'll switch to another song. They'll jump around. And I wonder if we're going to get to the point where it's unreasonable to ask somebody's attention for 3 minutes just listening to music. And then what do you do? Well, you give it to them in 1 second chunks.
Our Luke Dubois piece Billboard is on the record Time Lapse. Trent Wolbe produced our story. Still ahead this hour, when the devil meets you at the crossroads offering limitless artistic glory in exchange for your soul, can you ever really say no?
You know, one way or another, we're always making some kind of bargain. We're all trading our minutes, you know, for something, for some sense of a lasting accomplishment.
Comics artist and guru Scott McCloud. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You can run, you can run. Tell my friend Willie Brown. You can run, you can run. Tell my friend Willie Brown. Standing at the crossroads, I believe I'm sinking down. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. So, what will be your legacy? How will you be remembered? And for how long? Those are the kinds of questions that keep lots of writers and artists awake at night. And they obsess the title character in a new graphic novel called The Sculptor. This guy is young, ambitious, and broke, and after a jolt of early success, can't get a gallery to show his work. Until he's presented with a magical deal he can't refuse. A superpower that lets him instantly shape any material of any size. And the only downside is, if he accepts the offer, he'll die in 200 days. The Sculptor is by Scott McCloud, the comics artist and the great theorist of comics art.
I think we are all forever, like, making that deal. We're all trading our minutes for, you know, for something, for some sense of a lasting accomplishment. You know, one way or another, we're always making some kind of bargain, you know, as we go through this world. And I thought this was an interesting one to explore.
Well, and as you say, it is not, as it was in Faust's case, his soul, whatever that means. It is, you got 200 days left, kid. So right. I guess that's more relatable.
Yeah, especially because we all have a number. We just don't know what that number is. In this case, he does.
Yeah. When you were 26 years old, if such a deal had been proffered, would you have thought about it?
I think I might have gone for it. It's kind of funny when I think back to me in my early 20s. I was trying to get my first comic published, and I do remember I was a little crazy, maybe I still am, but I was really obsessed with nuclear war. This was the early 80s of the Reagan era.
Right.
And
the freeze.
Yeah, exactly. I thought for sure there'd be a nuclear war any day now. And I swear to God, when I was looking at publishers for this particular comic, I actually went with the one that could publish in a month earlier, because what if there was a nuclear war and my comic never came out? It's a very crazy way to think, but I guess I was able to relate to his slightly crazy way of looking at the world because of that.
You grew up outside Boston. What was there a specific comic book or experience as a kid that made you say, comics, that's my life?
Yeah, actually, I was 15 years old when I decided I want to make comics for a living. And I vividly remember seeing an old Jim Steranko X-Men comic in a friend's playroom while his little brother was watching the Banana Splits. I don't know. That's very, very distinct memory. And it had all kinds of crazy effects in it. And I thought, wow, comics can be really creative and weird. I was into surrealism in those days. I was a weird kid. But I looked at that stuff and I actually thought to myself, not in these exact words, but what I thought basically was, wow, comics have potential. Comics can do new and interesting things. And that's still kind of why I'm drawn to them, because of what they can do almost more than what they have done.
Yeah. I was interested to see, very interested to see, that your father had been this successful aeronautical engineer and was blind. And I'm curious, I mean, what kind of bearing that had on your decision to become a comic book artist?
Well, I always thought it was very charitable of him to encourage me to follow my dreams as an artist, because he had no proof I was any good at it. Or maybe if he could have seen it, he wouldn't have been so encouraging. But yeah, I always thought that was pretty cool. I mean, I think what he saw in me was that I had this, you know, fierce passion for the stuff. And I was very passionate. It's very obsessive, you know. When I got interested in things as a kid, or as an adult for that matter, I didn't take it halfway.
So David, the character, has made his deal and he's able to bend and shape material, anything, according to his vision, and makes all of his work in one frenzied night. And it kind of sucks, or it's not great.
Yeah, we leave it aside, the judgment of how much it sucks, but it's definitely judged to suck by plenty of people who probably know what they're talking about.
So is the lesson here that you can have preternatural technical virtuosity and energy and inspiration, but if you don't have sort of an idea or taste, you're out of luck?
Yeah, that and the fact that when you take away all those barriers and you get a direct conduit to everything you ever wanted to do, you come up against the ultimate wall, which is, what do you want to do? Why do you want to do
right.
it? And this
right.
is the thing that he hadn't really thought through.
As a 26-year-old might not have.
Right, as most 26-year-olds, I think, probably have.
Right. I mean, that's my memory of 26 is having great, enormous creative ambition like this guy. But like, if somebody had said, what exactly do you want to say and do? I would have been hebbity, hebbity, hebbity.
Yeah, exactly. I think we tend to focus on the things that are holding us back sometimes, and that prevents us from really confronting the fact that they aren't ultimately what's holding us back at all, not those external barriers at all.
There is also a love story here. David falls for a woman named Meg who happens also to wrestle with depression. Is that a character you built out of whole cloth or from life, or who is she?
No, it's semi-autobiographical. Meg came, a lot of her came from my wife, Ivy, and our relationship and, you know, her own struggles with depression and a lot of other aspects of her life. And especially whenever I sat down to write her lines of dialogue, I found it was a lot easier if I just kind of heard my wife's voice.
Amid the overwhelmingly positive reviews of this book, there has been some criticism of the Meg character.
Oh, yeah.
And I wonder if that, given that she's based on your wife, has been particularly hard to read or hear.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Definitely the trope of the manic pixie dream girl has come up. I was in a bit of a trap. I knew about it while I was working on the book, but I felt like I was kind of strapped to the conveyor belt heading for the buzzsaw. There was no escaping it because, you know, to some extent I married a trope. And I have some complex feelings about this because I see the use of things like archetypes as kind of on a continuum, you know, somewhere between Alice Munro and Little Red Riding Hood.
Right.
And why is it that this particular archetype was kind of marked for destruction as soon as we named her? Whereas archetypes associated with genres that are usually consumed by boys and men kind of get a pass.
Uh-huh.
There are certainly toxic applications of that character, maybe plenty of them. But there's something interesting about that kind of Dionysian character coming up against an Apollonian dullard protagonist that I think is worthwhile, and it's a story that is worth telling, even telling again.
God, you do talk like a professor. I want to look with you at a scene from the book. Here, the artist David is about to have a nervous breakdown, yeah. Which won't be the first or last time that he's had some kind of breakdown in this book.
Yeah.
So describe for us what's happening here.
Well, David hasn't eaten for 3 or 4 days. He's homeless and alone and really beginning to hallucinate. And he's standing in a subway station, and he's starting to scream at his hands. You see his hands rising to his face as the subway train is screeching behind it. And he just starts running at the subway train and battering it with his hands.
And as this part of the story goes on, the gutter space disappears and the letters sort of start moving around the images. It does this very good thing of feeling claustrophobic.
When those spaces between the panels disappear and you have these big black lines and it all goes out to the edge of the page, it's giving you that sense of everything just filling your senses. The sound fills your senses. The images fill your senses.
Right.
You know, the thing to remember with comics is that everything has to be funneled through sight. But if you've done your job right, you can somehow evoke sound and smell and taste and emotion and all these other human experiences through that one sense. That's one of the things I always try to do.
You are best known for having produced 3 books over a couple of decades, the books about the history and theory and making of comic books. So was it a case where, okay, I'm in my 40s, I'm approaching 50, I better do my big masterwork of graphic novel rather than just being the guy who has told everybody what to think about them?
Well, I had to do something in fiction. It bugged me that I hadn't done anything that I really liked. And, you know, if I had been talking about comics all this time and never got around to making a big one, it seemed like a bit of a waste.
And this is an impossible question, but I will ask it anyway. If would the critic, Scott McCloud, think, yeah, pretty good job? Or what would you think if you were reviewing this book?
I would think pretty good job, but I'm easy to please.
Oh, good.
I'm not a real harsh critic because I usually don't critique other people's comics. I just write about the possibilities and anything that pushes the envelope in any direction, I usually kind of like.
Well, I just read that Sony and the big producer of high-end movies, Scott Rudin, have bought the rights to turn The Sculptor into a movie. So, first of all, congratulations.
Thanks.
How do you feel about this prospect?
You know, usually I'm a real comics loyalist, and I'm really only interested in the one format. But in this case, I had to admit, even as I was working on it, it just felt like a story that would travel. But still very early on the movie front. Don't expect that one to hit theaters for a long time.
Do you wish to, or will you be involved in the making of a film?
At this point, I think probably towards the beginning, I would love to have a seat at the table, but, you know, I know how these things can break your heart if you have the illusion that you can somehow be a one-man movie-making team. It doesn't really work that way. So, you know, at a certain point, you know, you just have to, you know, step out of the bobsled and let it go, which is an imperfect bobsled metaphor, but you know what I mean.
It has been a pleasure, Scott McCloud. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
The Sculptor is out now, and you can see some panels from the book at studio360.org. Scott McCloud's great nonfiction trilogy, starting with Understanding Comics, influenced a whole generation of artists. People like Jessica Abel, who started publishing her comics in the 1990s. And now Jessica Abel, in turn, is teaching a new generation of artists, starting with her husband, Matt Madden. She told us about discovering comics as a college freshman in the 1980s who thought she was just a little too cool for school.
I'd already been involved in the punk scene in Chicago, going to shows for at least 3 years before that, and thinking of myself as this kind of city kid and being really interested in being in the city. And then I sent myself to this town of 12,000 people and a school of 1,200 people, and this chilled out, you know, Midwestern campus. And I think I pretty much got there, and it was like day one that I thought, what have I done? I was a complete freak at this school. And so I think I spent my entire freshman year getting like more and more wound up. So I'd like go to the student union where nobody was. Everybody was off at parties, various places. And I like turn on Headbangers Ball and like sit right in front of the TV and like turn it all the way up and be like, yes! And the town has, you know, one cool store. And they had a bunch of really interesting comics that I hadn't seen before. They had Read Yourself Raw. They had Jimbo in Paradise. And they had Love and Rockets. Just immediately spoke to me. I mean, first of all, it's beautiful. I mean, it's beautifully drawn. And the titles was very compelling. And it just felt like this is going to be good. Love and Rockets is a comic book series by a pair of brothers, Jaime and Gilbert Hernandez. And he tells the story of this tragic, attractive gangster character, Speedy. Maggie, who is the main character throughout this entire series, has a giant crush on him, and he is completely crushable. I mean, I had a giant crush on him, too. I could identify with Maggie so strongly, the way that she was a punk rock kid, but never so sure of herself. They're in a Mexican town outside L.A., very poor neighborhood. Even though it's not my environment, Jaime is so good at telling us about that world that it feels like you can know it. It's a world you want to enter into, even at its grubbiest, even at its sort of meanest. That's when I really started feeling like I could take hold of this identity for myself and build it and do something with it. You know, even though comics are so hard, prose is so limited in its ability to depict facial expressions, the way people communicate nonverbally. It's so incredibly clunky to talk about how a character blinked, you know? But that's how I think. I mean, I think in terms of how characters move and act. Jaime is still drawing Maggie, and she's now in her 40s. You know, I'm almost the same age. I'm a couple years younger than Maggie, I guess. But I've been basically almost her same age all the way along and sort of lived her life with her all the way along as a reader. So remembering what happened in 1992, she's also remembering what happened in 19. You know, I mean, there's this kind of, I have a very strange relationship with that book, you know, more than any other comic. Well, it is a boy's world, but it didn't bother me that it was a boy's world. Being female and wanting to do this was like my opportunity to be punker than I was before. I would have been thrilled if there were more women involved in it. But it was a cool challenge that there weren't. You know, it was worth it to embrace comics and to draw comics, to kind of put myself out there as a kind of weirdo.
That's Jessica Abel talking about Love and Rockets by Jaime and Gilbert Hernandez. Catherine Epstein produced our story. Is there some comic book or song or video game or dance piece or other cultural work that really helped make you who you are? Tell us about it at studio360.org, and we might put your story on the air. And that is it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Ital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
Matt Fidler,
Sean Ramisferam,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Krista Ripple,
Kasia Pila,
Kate Gill,
Rhiannon Corby,
Kayla Hoke.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum, and no thanks this week to Chris Bannon. After many years of dispensing true wisdom and solving all kinds of problems here at WNYC, of being my absolutely indispensable collaborator and friend here, Chris has moved on to new adventures. Chris Bannon, we miss you already. Best of luck in everything.
Studio 360's series on creativity and science is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information is online at sloan.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Cassandra Wilson's got a voice like no other woman in jazz.
I'm actually a baritone. You can't call me a baritone because I'm a woman. Remember. Especially in the blues, I'm really attracted to the men's stories, not the women's stories. I don't do victim.
Cassandra Wilson, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.